I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Last week, there was a large demonstration in Mexico City protesting government corruption and the disappearance of 43 college students back in September. They were last seen in Iguala and are presumed dead. The mayor of Iguala and his wife are in custody after being on the lam, accused of ordering the police to seize the students who then allegedly handed them over to drug gangs. Protesters express frustration over the handling of this horrific crime. Today on Radio Times, we focus on our neighbor to the south and its president, who was elected almost 2 years ago, and we have two guests who have joined us. Tracy Wilkinson is the Mexico bureau chief for the LA Times. Her coverage was part of a Team Overseas Press Club Award and a Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award, and this year she won the Maria Moores Cabot Prize from the Columbia School of Journalism. And Tracy Wilkinson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Duncan Wood. He's director of the Mexico Institute. That's at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He's a member of the Editorial Board of Foreign Affairs. And Duncan Wood, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for inviting me.
Tracy, let me begin with you and even begin with this disappearance of these 43 students. It's been several months now. What is known about about what happened to them?
Well, what the government says now, having captured a lot of the members of the drug cartel that was operating in that region, they believe that these students, after being captured by the local police, were handed over to a local cartel that then killed them and burned their bodies and tossed the remains into the river. They still don't have DNA evidence to establish that the remains they've found are these students, but I think it's generally thought that that's what happened to them, that they were killed. And the more important issue is that it really exposed a level of corruption that went into City Hall, into the police force, and perhaps, you know, much higher.
Tracy, why were these 43 students targeted in particular? What is it about them that made them a unique kind of target?
Well, they're students from a college system of rural schools for poor kids, you know, sons and daughters of campesinos, of peasant farmers. That is something that was established, you know, more than 100 years ago in the revolution. And they had an antagonistic relationship for a long time with some city officials in the state of Guerrero, which is in this case where this happened. And so the mayor of Iguala, the city where they disappeared, there's a long history of back and forth where, you know, he allegedly killed a leftist activist, and they reacted and burned, you know, attacked City Hall. And so now, when this happened, these students were on their way to Iguala, city of Iguala, and it was a time when the mayor's wife was having a big event to celebrate her achievements as head of a social welfare agency. And so the mayor didn't want them to disrupt this event, and so he ordered his police chief to take care of the students, allegedly. And so there's been a long sort of antagonistic relationship between these students and some local officials, but in this case it obviously went to the extreme.
I mean, it's a horrifying story. To you, Duncan Wood, what does this tell us about Mexico?
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, obviously it's a great human tragedy, and I think that's one of the most important things to remember as we analyze all of this, and that's one of the most important features in understanding how Mexicans have reacted. But what does this tell us about Mexico is your question, and I think it tells us that, you know, Mexico's reality is complex. For the last 2 years, we've seen that most of the news coming out of Mexico has been positive news about the, you know, ambitious reform agenda of the government. And all of that has been true. I mean, all of those good things have been happening. But throughout the entire two-year period, I mean, since President Peña Nieto's election in July of 2012, his taking of office on the 1st of December 2012, you see that you know, the public security problems have continued in Mexico. The institutional weaknesses at the local level have continued. And I have to mention at this point that, you know, we have to recognize the important contribution that that the LA Times has made, and in particular Tracy's team, you know, on reporting the more complex reality of Mexico throughout all of this. So you have a lot of good news that's happened in Mexico over the past 2 years, but a lot of the problems which have existed there for a long time, you know, at least going back to, you know, 2006, 2007, are still there. And that is that as the country advances, as it modernizes, a lot of that progress is actually restricted to the biggest cities in the country and rural areas, particularly in states such as Guerrero, Michoacán, Tamaulipas, Oaxaca, you know, which are cut off from the metropolis, as it were. They continue to suffer many of the same problems that they've suffered for decades, if not centuries. And that's one of the problems that we see in Mexico, is this uneven development. So, you know, as much as we want to celebrate the very real progress that's happening in Mexico, these are problems which are persistent, and they really do hold back the country's development.
Tracy, do you think these protests, and my understanding from your reporting and other people's reporting, is that they have been pretty large, do you think they could be a turning point in dealing with not just this, as I said, this horrific disappearance and presumed death of 43 students, but also what it says about government corruption?
That's a good question, and I hear that a lot. Is this a turning point? Because, you know, there have been a few moments in the last 5 or 6 years where something horrific has happened. You know, 15 kids killed in Juarez at a party, a soccer party, and 73 immigrants slaughtered in Tamaulipas. But and nothing really came. I mean, there were minor changes, but nothing really major came of either of those things. And so we look at this and say, is this a turning point? And I do think there's something different about now. I mean, I look at these demonstrations, and the people there come from a really broad range of experiences and ages and classes even. But I do think that it's still a long way to go before there to be real change in Mexico. And it's hard to see that this is how this will transform into anything else, but this definitely has a different feel, in the sense that the anger goes beyond just one group or one political or one ideology. It does go much farther beyond that.
Let me jump in here.
Yeah,
if you don't
go ahead,
mind,
Duncan. No, please
do. Say that you know, this is really a defining moment for this presidency in Mexico. The President Peña Nieto has his legacy issue already, which is the opening of the energy sector. But this issue will define his presidency in a very different way, which is that the government, and in particular a pre-government, the Revolutionary Institutional Party, which ruled Mexico for so long and came back into power in 2012 after a 12-year absence, you know, is this a party and is this a government that's willing to recognize how much Mexican society has changed, how much more demanding it is, and how much more it expects from its government? And if the president and his team are not willing to accept that and not willing to respond to that, then it'll be very difficult for them to be remembered as a successful government. If, however, they learn the lessons from what has happened, they see how vociferous and vehement the reaction has been from Mexican society to this particular tragedy, and they begin to react by strengthening institutions, by dealing with the questions of corruption, transparency, accountability, by really focusing on the crucial questions of justice reform and police reform in the Mexican system, then this can be a turning point for the government. It can be a turning point for the country. And hopefully this is something which will define what's left of this presidency. But as Tracy indicates, unfortunately, that we have very little evidence so far that the government is willing and able of making that big step forward. And I think that's what, as international observers and people who care about Mexico, that's what we're all waiting to see.
Well, yes, I say that's exactly right, that I don't think so far this government has shown that flexibility and that willingness to acknowledge that this is really a serious problem. The rhetoric and the speeches and the comments we're hearing so far from Peña Nieto himself and from the army and from the head of the Supreme Court have all been very hard line and sort of trying to portray the protest movement as something very, tending towards violence and this kind of thing. And they're trying, I think basically to discredit it. And they're not really facing, that I can see so far, the real fundamental issues that they should deal with now.
Well, Tracy, I was reading about a hashtag from some of the protesters, the hashtag being, I am tired of fear. What's that in reference to?
I'm tired of fear. when the Attorney General finally gave a press conference that sort of the definitive, I guess, press conference that said, well, we found these remains. We think they are the students, the 43 students that were missing. He gave a press conference and took questions for a while. And then at the end, he finally said, after many questions, he said, yeah, me kunsi, I'm tired of this. And he ended the press conference.
Oh,
so that became a sort of rallying cry of the protest movement. You're tired of taking questions. What about us being tired of this system, this government, this lack of attention to violence and corruption and impunity? And I think that's where that comes from. And it has really had a galvanizing effect for many people here.
Duncan, going back to you, from your perspective, what would be a sign that the government gets it? Would it be not just arrests, but that people are put on trial and there are there's transparency in the system so that people can see a judicial system at work?
Yeah, I think there are probably four steps that we need to see. The first one is that the government actually makes a much more explicit recognition of the human dimension of this tragedy. You know, at least for the first month after the incident occurred, it seemed as though this was being handled in a very cold-blooded way. And, you know, the president's refusal to travel to Guerrero to meet with the parents of the family really showed that there is a great distance between the current administration and the Mexican people. When eventually he did meet with the parents, they had to travel to Mexico City to meet with him. It was a meeting that occurred in private. We're not sure whether that was a condition imposed by the parents or by the president. I mean, the official version is that the parents didn't want there to be any cameras there. When the parents emerged from the meeting, they were less than satisfied, to say the least, with the meeting that occurred. And I think that what we really need to see from both the president, his cabinet, but also I think from his broader entourage, is a recognition that this is a great tragedy, not just the human tragedy for the families, but the human tragedy for Mexico, which is that this is a recognition that it's not just the 43 people involved here, it's all of the thousands of disappeared people in Mexico. It's the tens of thousands, maybe over 100,000 people who have died because of drug violence over the past 8 years or so. And they want to see the Mexican state, more than just the government and this particular president, they want to see the state recognizing that this is a great human tragedy.
And that's
the second stage,
I see. Well, you know, hold on to that thought, yeah, only because we have to take a very short break. And
sure,
that's Duncan Wood, who joins us along with Tracy Wilkinson. And we're talking about Mexico in this hour of Radio Times, the disappearance and apparent death of 43 students that disappeared back in September. Taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. We're talking about Mexico, getting the latest news from Mexico, talking with award-winning journalist Tracy Wilkinson. She's Mexico bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. And with Duncan Wood, he's the director of the Mexico Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. You can give us a call, any questions or comments. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Duncan, let me go back to you and give you a chance to finish what you want.
Sorry about that.
That's okay, the Mexican government to do in response to this disappearance and apparent death of 43 students.
Sure. So in addition to recognizing the human dimension of this tragedy, I think the second thing is to actually begin to engage in a much more holistic way with Mexican society. And you know, what we've seen over the past 8 years or so is that those communities that have really been able to bounce back after incidents of violence or breakdowns of public security have been those in which the government at its three levels, federal, state, and municipal, the private sector, and civil society have come together to work to make communities more resilient. And I think that's one of the things that this government needs to recognize more explicitly. It already has programs in place which are supposedly addressing this issue, but it needs to work harder on it. Third stage, of course, is to actually, you know, investigate, arrest, prosecute, and put the responsible people in jail. Some people have already been arrested, right. And the government has done a respectable job of actually investigating the crime up to this point. But it needs to work harder. It needs to show that justice is actually being done. And I would say that the fourth level, and this is perhaps the most important, is to begin to strengthen institutions. And so you mentioned justice reform. Justice reform is crucial. We have a program in place since 2008 to really change Mexico's justice system at the national and state level. And the government needs to push state governments to do all of that.
Well, let me do want to go back to you, Tracy, and actually picking up on some of the things that Duncan said and shifting gears slightly to talk about Juarez. And I remember doing interviews a couple of years ago about Juarez when it was called the murder capital of the world. Is Juarez an example of what can happen in Mexico when it comes to reform and reducing some of the violence connected to the drug trade?
Well, possibly. It depends. Many people think Juarez happened because the drug cartels who were fighting over Juarez made a deal, and that is when violence subsided. But at the same time, the important thing, and this has happened in Juarez, Tijuana, Monterrey, business groups, you know, get together and they really demand that there be a halt to the violence and a response from the government, because you know it's money, it's the bottom line, it's, you know, these are places that need to thrive economically, and when there is that counterbalance to the violence, that works. I think Duncan makes a really good point when he says that this government, the federal government, has not really recognized how serious the problem is, or at least publicly recognized how serious the problem is, and that, you know, they really need to confront in a lot of cities how serious and how deep this corruption goes. They've tried to centralize as a presidential system. They've tried to centralize a lot of the security and the other forces of the states, but you know they're sort of, that leaves behind a lot of the local government, and that's what has to be tackled now.
Tracy, when you say the drug cartels made a deal in Juarez, made a deal with whom?
Well, that's a good question. I guess with each other, and with law enforcement in some cases. I think in Juarez, what often happens is one cartel wins out, and when one cartel wins, that the violence goes down because one cartel is in charge, and I think that's what happens, and then that cartel can make an agreement with the ruling authorities. That's what we've seen in many places. In Monterrey, it's a different case, because this is Mexico's most important industrial economic city, and there's a very strong economic class that could fight back and say, you know, we won't take this. And so they've established some very strong law enforcement forces there. But that's rare, and that's a very rich city, and that's not what happens in most of Mexico.
And Duncan, how much is the United States implicated in the drug business as it comes out of Mexico?
Well, I mean, it's very well known. It's been discussed on thousands of occasions about how there has to be a sense of shared responsibility between Mexico and the United States for the violence that occurs in Mexican territory. Obviously because of the demand problem for drugs in the United States, we also have that very real question of the weapons that flow south across the border. And regardless of whether they're bought legally in the United States, exporting those weapons to Mexico is not legal. And so we have to be very aware of that. But I think that, we've seen an extraordinary change in the conversation between the Mexican and U.S. governments, from where we were 10 years ago, for example, so that now there is this sense of shared responsibility or co-responsibility for the problem. And the incredible innovation of the Merida Initiative that has been underway for the past 6 years or so is very welcome. And the Merida Initiative, which you know sets up these cooperative mechanisms between the United States and the Mexican governments to work together to fight organized crime. It recognizes the weaknesses of the Mexican judicial system. It recognizes the weaknesses of the police forces. It focuses on questions like training. It also focuses on strengthening communities to make them more resilient. It focuses on questions of disrupting organized crime, you know, the interdictions, the arrests and the eliminations of senior figures. And it really strikes at the heart of what is needed in Mexico, which is that this is something which is going to take a long time, but we really do have to increase levels of transparency, accountability, and make institutions simply work better.
Let me ask you, Tracy, about something else. And this is the wife of the president of Mexico, Angelica Rivera. And she had to explain a purchase for a mansion. I wonder if you could just sort of fill us in on that story and what you think it says about the government in Mexico.
Well, it's being seen as yet another example of corruption here. She purchased this, you know, gorgeous mansion that she apparently, according to the reports, had developed and built to her specifications. A huge $7 million white marble mansion, seven bedrooms, pools, etc. But the problem is that she was buying it from a contractor who also had received hundreds of millions of dollars of contracts from the government of the state of Mexico, which is the state that kind of surrounds Mexico City, while her husband, well, not then at the husband, but while Peña Nieto, now the president, then the governor, was in charge. And so same contractor who received hundreds of millions of dollars of contracts from the government, and then builds her this house supposedly, and gives her loans to buy buy the house, and then several weeks ago this company wins a contract to build a $4 billion bullet train from Mexico City. So the appearance of conflict of interest is very deep, and they didn't seem to get it, only until various local media and international media exposed this did they finally kind of back down and said, okay, well, we won't buy this mansion. But the appearance of conflict of interest was sort of, one more piece of evidence for a lot of Mexicans that the government and the system is, so favors nepotism, corruption, and conflicts of interest that people don't even, that the higher-ups don't even realize.
That's Tracy Wilkinson. She's Mexico Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. Most recently won the Maria Moores Cabot Prize from the Columbia School of Journalism. Also with us, Duncan Wood. He's the director of the Mexico Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Also a member of the editorial board of Foreign Affairs. Both of them joining us, giving us an update on what is going on in our neighbor to the south in Mexico. And to join our conversation again, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. I see some Facebook comments and some emails as well. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Duncan, I want to read a comment from Gerard from Nazareth. He says, I don't think the Mexicans will ever be able to clean up their politics. Corruption is woven into the system. It doesn't matter who the president is. They won't be able to change things. Do you share his pessimism?
Absolutely not. I mean, all you have to do is to go back, let's say, 100 years or 150 years in Britain, or as recently as 30 years ago in the United States, in places like Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago, to see how rife corruption was, both in city government and in police forces, and to see the problem that existed with organized crime at that time. Now, what were countries like Great Britain and the United States able to do? Over a long period of time, by making very brave decisions, they were able to strengthen their institutions. And I, quite honestly, having lived in Mexico for 17 years, I don't buy into the idea that it is a that corruption is culturally obligatory in Mexico. I think it's the structure of incentives that are in place, and I think this is what, you know, a careful study of corruption around the world teaches us, that if the incentives are in place to prevent you from being corrupt, then you'll stop being corrupt. And the very simple example that I always use for this is to say, look at how people drive in Mexico City. It's a little bit crazy, it's a little bit lawless. But get those same drivers crossing the border into the United States, they behave exceedingly well, often better than American citizens do. Why? Because they're frightened of the consequences. And that's exactly what has to happen in Mexico. We have to change the institutions, we have to change the legal framework, and we actually have to change the culture, if you will, by changing the incentive structure that exists in the country. And I firmly believe that that is possible. It takes a long time, it requires a lot of effort, but it can be done.
Can it be done, Tracy?
I agree totally with Duncan. You know, it's you know, you see drivers, you said drivers, but you know, this idea of once someone goes to the United States, of course they obey all the laws. It's not a cultural thing, as in fact Peña Nieto himself has tried to portray it. I just think that, but it does take time. And you know, I covered the L.A. riots in the early 90s, and 20 years later, the L.A. police force is a very different police force. But it does take time, and it takes dedication. And unfortunately, in Mexico, you have a system where there isn't this continuity in terms of reformation. But I do think there is a chance, but it will take, you know, it'll take some really smart people to do it.
you laugh there, Tracy. What is the public opinion about the president 2 years into his office? How is he faring?
Not so well. His marks are pretty low right now. He's he's dealing with so many protest movements on so many fronts. He's popular, obviously, with the business community and with the elite, but the general public is not very happy with him, and actually his ratings are pretty low. I think, you know, there was a lot of concern when he came into office that he was he brought obviously the Institutional Revolution Party back to government after a long time, and there's a lot of apprehension about will it be the old PRI or will it be the new PRI, and it's so far, I think it's a mixed bag. You know, you have some very smart people who are doing wonderful things in terms of reform, but as we said earlier, he doesn't seem to have a pulse on the popular opinion, and he doesn't seem to take criticism very well.
We have a website comment from LK saying all the students kidnapped and evidently brutally murdered were male. Is that true, Tracy?
They were all male? Yes, it is true. Traditionally, those colleges, these rural colleges that was part of the system that grew up out of the revolution, were all male. They're not all male anymore. They do have women students. But in this case, the ones that were taken away were all male, yes.
And Doug, when you look at the violence, I guess, related to the drug cartels in Mexico, are the victims largely male? Do we know?
Overwhelmingly so, yes. Although over the past few years, we have seen more incidents of female victims and also women who are directly involved in the business of organized crime. But still today, I mean, it's overwhelmingly a male game. And I would have to say that, organized crime in Mexico and violence in Mexico is overwhelmingly a young man's game. And this is actually one of the interesting features about the evolution of the violence in Mexico, is that when the drug cartels, organized crime groups, were run by, men in their 50s and, early 60s, it was less violent, as we've seen the elimination, either through, killing or through arrest, of the leaders of these cartels. It's created a certain amount of chaos within the organized crime groups as younger men have battled each other to try to take over the leadership. And as the analyst Peter Reuter has said on many occasions, violence is a young man's game because they have less to lose and so much more to win. And so we've seen that in Mexico play out time and time again. And, you know, that hits upon one of the big developmental problems and challenges of the country, which is how do you provide real economic opportunities for young men, particularly in rural areas, but also in urban areas, to actually move ahead? You know, in the past, one of the options has been migration, either to cities or to the United States. But today there's the other option, which is go into organized crime, make a lot of money very, very quickly. And that's something that we have to think about as well.
Are there job opportunities, Tracy?
Not really. I mean, there have been some, there are some expansions in some sectors of the economy, which does help some. But generally, no. I mean, you know, as Duncan said, a lot of these young guys are, or young males, are not, you know, they have nowhere to go. And what they call here the ninis, they don't study, they don't work. There's over a million people who cannot find a job. You know, they do study, and then they get out and they don't find a job. Or they, you know, they no longer study and they have nothing to go. So there is a great lack of opportunity for most people in Mexico. There are some who do, you know, manage to advance and go into the advancing sectors of economy, but it's still a vast number of people who really have no opportunity.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about Mexico in this hour of Radio Times. Much going on in that country. Tracy Wilkinson, again, the Mexico Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. She has won a number of awards, including most recently the Maria Moores Cabot Prize from the Columbia School of Journalism. Duncan Wood, also with us, Director of the Mexico Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and member of the Editorial Board of Foreign Affairs. And again, you can join our conversation, 1-888-477-9499. You can leave a comment on our Facebook page. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. If you're just joining us, I'm talking about Mexico with Duncan Wood and Tracy Wilkinson. And we have a comment actually from Cyril from our Facebook page. He says, why hasn't what hasn't been mentioned is that the violence, much of it state violence and impunity, spiked after the U.S. Merida Initiative or Plan Colombia for Mexico, which dumped billions in unaccountable military aid to an already dubious government. Duncan, I'm going to toss that first to you.
Thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
First of all, you know, we're looking at between $1.6 and $2 billion in total spending, some of which actually hasn't been spent so far because of delays. And that includes programs for Mexico and for Central America. Second point, the accountability question. Is the money being dumped in there willy-nilly? Absolutely not. It's been one of the biggest complaints from the Mexican government is they wanted to have access to the resources much more quickly. But the U.S. government, quite rightly, in my opinion, has insisted on finding out exactly how the money is going to be spent, who the partners are, doing proper vetting, et cetera, et cetera. Third point, which is really the crux of the question here, is has violence gone up since the Merida Initiative began? The answer is yes, but I would question whether or not it was the Merida Initiative that was responsible. Really, the key moment here in the violence is the President Calderon, the previous president of Mexico, his decision to take on organized crime and the drug cartels, which then the U.S. government supported through the Merida Initiative. And we can see that there has been a definite, sharp trajectory upwards in terms of violence and homicide levels in Mexico since then. But in fact, a lot of great research has been done, particularly by my colleague David Shirk out at the University of San Diego and his Justice in Mexico project, which shows that violence was actually picking up before Calderon came into power, particularly in the state of Michoacán and up in northern Mexico, which shows that there was trouble brewing before he even made this decision. So what I have to say is that there was going to be rising violence anyway. I have little doubt that, in fact, the decision by the Calderon administration to take on the cartels exacerbated the problem. Do I believe that the Merida Initiative has made it worse? I actually think the Merida Initiative has helped to temper the problem. Most importantly, by helping communities to strengthen after violence has taken over. And the examples of Tijuana, Ciudad Juarez, and Monterrey are key examples here. So I think if you actually dig beneath the surface here, you begin to find out that there's a much more complex reality at work.
Tracy, you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think that when I first got to Mexico in 2008, you know, the briefings I was getting from the Calderón government is that they really feared that drug cartels were starting to take over governments of parts of Mexico and you know, take over parts of the state, and that is something they could not tolerate. And so I think there was a lot of justification for what they did at the time.
Let me ask you something else, Tracy. And I was thinking about this in preparation for the show today, and like every other radio show, we did a number of programs about the migrants largely from El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, who the stream, lots of young children even, and teenagers coming to the U.S. border, coming into Texas, going through Mexico. But I thought what was so interesting is that there were not a lot of Mexicans among these migrants, and we've been talking about the problems of violent drug cartels in Mexico. Is there some significance to that, do you think?
Well, for a long time, yes, it was Mexicans who were crossing over, but it became so dangerous because a lot of these, you know, we call them cartels. That's not necessarily what they are anymore. These, you know, gangs that controlled people trafficking. And they pretty much seized the transport of people across Mexico, which meant that it became much more dangerous, much more deadly, and fewer Mexicans were going. But Central Americans, you know, it's the situation in those countries is so dire in Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala, where these people are desperately trying to get out of very violent, very poor countries. And so they were coming across Mexico, and but unfortunately these cartels, you know, they looked for a new business, and the new business was transporting migrants. And so these migrants started transporting these people across Mexico, and that became, you know, the bulk of migration across Mexico.
Duncan Wood, let me put something else on the table here for discussion. So if Mexico wants to attract international investors, and the president was meeting in China just a couple of weeks ago, I guess got in trouble in part because he was leaving the country while all these crises were going on. But nonetheless, what does Mexico need to do to attract investors?
Well, I think that it's doing many of the right things. I mean, we had a record year for investment last year by Mexican standards, and we expect that particularly 2015, 2016 will be very, very good years for foreign direct investment in Mexico as a result of the opening of the energy sector, which is expected to add between $10 and $20 billion in annual investment for the next couple of years. You know, that is a huge deal for the international community, and in particular for the international oil and gas business. And so, you know, it's done many of the right things, and we're seeing the importance not just of the energy opening, but also of reform of the telecom sector. There was a very important labor law reform in Mexico in the fall of 2012, and we've seen a number of other major reforms taking place as well. But, you know, to play devil's advocate here, and of course, you know, to touch back on the subject that really focuses our attention today, you know, as long as the rule of law question in Mexico is not resolved, and as long as we don't really see major improvements in rule of law, and I don't just mean levels of, you know, organized crime, homicides, etc., but basic questions such as property rights and respecting contracts, that's always going to be a drag on economic development in Mexico. It's going to slow down both foreign direct investment and investment by Mexican companies, to be honest with you, because what companies want and what business wants is a reliable, dependable, predictable environment in which to make investment decisions. And Mexico has made great progress on that, but it still has some way to go.
And Tracy, is energy, I mean, as we know, a lot of oil, I guess even natural gas coming out of Mexico, is that the kind of prime mover of the economy?
Yeah, it's a big, it's very important, and I agree totally with Duncan that, you know, you you can do all you want to do in terms of promoting this industry, but until there's security, until these companies can come here and work safely, it's going to be a problem. But yes, no, that's definitely an important mover in the economy.
What about tourism? Are tourists staying away from Mexico, Tracy, because of some of these reports?
Exactly. Well, Acapulco, you know, is the usual. We just have a holiday here, and Acapulco normally attracts, you know, millions, gazillions, nice. Thousands and thousands of tourists. And a few days before the holiday, the protesters over the missing 43 students seized the airport and basically surrounded it, causing some disruption in airline service. And so after that, 40,000 people, canceled their flights, and so it's definitely a problem. On the other hand, you still have tons of people coming to Cancun and certain parts of Mexico, but it does have an economic effect, and that's important for the government to take into consideration.
What's intriguing about the tourist numbers, of course, is that over the past few years, the number of U.S. tourists traveling to Mexico has dropped off. As the stories about the violence and the lawlessness in, largely in non-tourist areas has really dominated the headlines. But tourism from Europe has picked up and tourism from Asia has picked up. So, in fact, last year was a record tourist year in terms of number of visitors and the total amount of dollars spent in Mexico by foreign tourists, which is intriguing, which really does hit upon how important the messaging is about a country. I fully expect that as things improve in Mexico, we'll see U.S. tourists returning.
Well, and picking up on that and going back to you, Tracy, and here we are doing a show about Mexico, largely talking about the problems which are real in that country, but whether we forget or omit or don't know about or don't promote some of the good stories or good news stories that come out of Mexico.
Well, I've been asked that question every posting I've been in.
I bet you have.
Why aren't you writing positive stories out of Jerusalem? Well, there's a bigger issue. We do write other things. We do cover other positive stuff, but you can't ignore the things that really could potentially shape policy and shape governments, and that's why I think we tend to focus on these more negative things. Unfortunately, I mean that's the role of the journalist, right?
Indeed, but I also think Duncan Wood is that this country spends a lot more time talking about what's going on in Europe, also in Southeast Asia, than we do about what's going on in Mexico.
Yeah, absolutely. And, the United States is a country that has global interest, obviously. And so sometimes it's difficult to compete on the news agenda with the events of the Middle East or in Russia or China. And so naturally there is this tendency to focus on the spectacular, and in this case, spectacular in a negative sense, things that have happened in Mexico. But as I said earlier on in the show, I think it's impressive that during the last 2 years, when most of the international media has focused on the good things that have happened in Mexico, there are outlets like the Los Angeles Times who have not got swept away by the hype about Mexico and have said, we recognize that there's a lot of good things going on there, but we have to recognize as well that there are still many challenges going on. Now, do I believe that Mexico should have more coverage? Absolutely. I mean, I would agree with many people who argue that there's no country that's actually more important for the United States than Mexico, simply because of the fact of the border, of the integrated economies, in particular the integrated production systems that exist between the two countries, so that U.S. jobs really depend upon Mexican prosperity more than any other country. And because, of course, that you have the increasing integration of the two societies, you know, partly through migration, partly through changing demographics, partly because of, you know, the two countries actually getting to spend more time together and citizens spending more time in the other country. And so I think that, you know, the futures of the United States and Mexico are tied together in a way which you see with no other country around the world. And that's why I think it's incumbent upon the media in general to educate the American people on what's happening in Mexico and what Mexico is really like as a country.
Let me get Rick from, looks like Hocus in Delaware, to join us. Rick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah. Wonderful show.
Thanks.
Mexico, a lot to work there. And there's a saying in Mexico that goes back to its best that's past.
You know what, Rick? I hate to do this to you, but we're just having a really hard time hearing you on your phone, and I'm going to just read what I see on my screen here and get Tracy Wilkinson to respond. Rick wanted to say, on the rule of law, there's an old saying in Mexico, there's no one between the Mexican president and God. In other words, he's authorized with a ton of power, way more than in the U.S. Is that true, Tracy?
Well, sort of. I mean, it's... Mexico has definitely made progress in giving its various institutions more power. So there is a Supreme Court that is very powerful now, and there is a what would be the equivalent of a Freedom of Information institution that they have here, and so there are more institutions that conceivably could provide balance of power, but he's right in that the presidency is kind of all powerful, and increasingly so with this government under this party. They're trying to centralize government more and more, but there are more institutions, and there is a press that is a little more free than it used to be. So, I mean, there are counterbalances, but you have a basic right point that you know, the presidency here is pretty powerful.
Oh, Rick, thanks for the comment.
I think if I can jump in here, that there's an interesting dimension, which is that in many senses, the presidency in Mexico has too much power, but in other senses, it's given up too much power. And I'm thinking here of the case of decentralization. You know, Mexico, like the United States, is a federal country. And over the past 20 years, we've seen a devolution of power and of resources from the federal government to state-level governments without improving their levels of accountability and transparency, and in particular, without seeing any strengthening of their institutions. And so what we have now is we have very powerful governors throughout the country. We have municipal presidents who receive, you know, relatively large budgets and have to respond to nobody and answer to nobody for those budgets. And what we need to see is I think, that the federal government, not just the office of the presidency, but I think ideally coming from the Congress, needs to demand that the states of Mexico and the municipalities of Mexico begin to improve their rule of law and their processes and protocols. Because otherwise, the reality that we see on a daily basis in Mexico City, where things actually work quite well, is not going to be repeated around the country.
Right, because most states, you know, these governors act as caciques, you know, as sort of all-powerful lords who can do what they want and can ignore any efforts at transparency, no?
We have to, we'll let that no kind of just hang out there, only because we have to end our discussion. And my thanks to both of you. Tracy Wilkinson, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She's Mexico Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. And Duncan Wood, thank you very much as well.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
You're welcome. And he's Director of the Mexico Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back with Hour 2.